Hello, bookworms, and welcome to Oh for the Love of Books. This show gives you information from the books I've read or ones you suggest for me to read. I'm your host, Jessica Vickery, and thank you for joining me. Here are the next two books in Heather Graham's Crew of Hunters. They're a secret government unit formed under the oversight of Adam Harrison, a famed paranormal investigator. The members he'd gathered know a little of the otherworldly. Each has honed a psychic talent of their own. Book 11, The Night is Forever. Prologue. There he was, Marcus Danby, dead in a ravine. His eyes were open and he stared up at the heavens. His limbs were twisted at odd angles, making him look like an image created by a mad artist. Marcus! Olivia Gordon cried his name as she dismounted and swiftly scampered down the rocks to his side. Like an idiot, she hunkered down by him, touching him, speaking, praying that somehow he was still alive as he lay there. But of course he wasn't. She studied his face, weathered, worn, beautiful with character, and silent tears slid down her cheeks. Marcus, she whispered, closing his eyes. Maybe it was the wrong thing to do. Maybe the medical examiner needed to see him exactly as he'd been found. But she wasn't leaving him now, and she couldn't bear to see his eyes open. He'd been staring up at the heavens, she thought, staring up at the sky above him. Ironically, the sky was exceptionally beautiful tonight. It was one of those twilights when the moon rose before the sun set completely, and the sun carried its fall, sinking lower and lower into the horizon. A soft, opaque glow seemed to settle over the landscape. The hills here, just outside Nashville, Tennessee, appeared to be some kind of fairy tale kingdom. Their rich shades of autumn, the gold, orange, and crimson leaves on the trees, highlighted the emerald green grasses. A slight cool touch to the air, making it clear and comfortable to breathe. The sky and the landscape were what Marcus had seen as he died, Olivia reminded herself. It was why Marcus had loved this area so much, this place where he'd been born. Maybe there was something fitting in that, something poetic. And yet, no question, Marcus had loved this countryside. He'd known it intimately. For that very reason, it seemed impossible that he'd fallen into this rocky ravine when he followed the same paths, on foot or horseback, almost every day of his life. Olivia heard Shiloh paw the ground. She looked up at her horse. He was obviously sensing her emotions, the change in her energy.
Easy, boy, easy,
Olivia said softly. We have to wait here. Fresh tears stung her eyes and cascaded down her cheeks. She wanted to rise up and throw her arms around Shiloh's neck, feeling the warmth of this living creature that she knew would be life-affirming. Like all animals at the horse farm, the therapy center Marcus Danby had founded and where Olivia worked, Shiloh was a rescue horse, near starvation. He'd been found in the Florida Redlands. Animal activists from the state had arranged his transport to the Nashville area, and there was something about him that had made him special to Olivia from the first time she'd seen him. He'd been a pile of bones, wild and terrified of people. He tried more than once to run her into a building to get her off his back. While the focus on the horse farm was teaching people to trust again through their relationship with animals, Shiloh was, to Olivia, one of her best success stories. Marcus had always told her that what she'd done with Shiloh was impressive, but what she managed with people was equally beautiful.
Oh, Marcus, what did you do? She whispered.
He probably been missing long before any of them realized he was gone.
because Marcus kept no set hours, didn't see patients, and came and went as he chose. He founded the horse farm. It was his passion and his life. But while he loved to make sudden appearances and engage with patients, he did so on his own time and his own terms. He'd been a wreck of a man himself, bipolar, an addict, homeless, and an ex-con. When he found a horse on a small farm, he'd, for some reason, been left through a family inheritance. Like Shiloh, the animal had been starved and beaten by a cruel master and was terrified. In earning the horse's trust and love, Marcus had learned to care about himself. He told Olivia once that he'd been so afraid something horrible would happen to the horse without him, he'd become determined to live. In saving that horse, Marcus had saved himself. It wasn't that he hadn't grown up around animals. He had. His father had raised some of the finest racing horses in Tennessee. Maybe because he'd had money as a child, Marcus had known that happiness had nothing to do with wealth. When he inherited the family land, he had no intentions in racehorses. He cared about people, damaged people. He'd been miraculously fixed by a horse, and he went on to find out how to help others in the same way. Olivia adored Marcus. Had adored him, she told herself. No, she did adore him. All that he'd been and all that he'd taught her would stay with her forever. He'd live in a small house on the property about a quarter mile from the stables, and the staff at the horse farm only knew he was gone because Sammy, his golden retriever, another rescue animal, had come to the stables, wet, tail between his legs, anxious. He'd been limping because he'd managed to gash his left leg quite badly. Aaron Bentley, managing director of the horse farm, had tried to believe that Marcus had driven somewhere and Sammy had hurt himself trying to catch up to him. But Marcus hadn't driven anywhere, not on his own anyway. His old Ford pickup was still in the driveway. And Olivia knew Marcus would have died before allowing any harm to come to his beloved Sammy. So they'd all become extremely worried. Aaron had called in the local authorities, and they'd set up a search. Olivia had the backwoods acreage, while others had been assigned to pond area, the pastures, and the adjoining farms, businesses, and residents. They had now been out searching for hours in their designated areas. She and Aaron, plus the other two therapists from the horse farm, Mason Garlano and Mariah Naughton. As well, the stable bosses Drew Dixon and Sydney Rowe had joined the search. And so had Deputy Sheriff Vine and his partner Jimmy Callahan. Only Sandra Cheever, known as Mama Cheever, the house manager for the offices, had remained behind. There were miles of pasture land and forest out there, enough to keep them riding and searching for many more hours. But dusk seemed to be coming on fast. Twilight. Twilight in these hills. A dangerous time up there if you didn't know your way. But Marcus hadn't fallen in the twilight. He'd had his accident, if accident it was, in the brightness of day. He was cold now, stone cold. Olivia didn't have many skills in forensics, but she was certain that he'd been here for some time. He hadn't fallen in dusk, a time when a tourist might become disoriented among the rolling hills, forested slopes, and rocky dips. This time of day frightened many people here. Kids told scary tales over campfires about the Civil War soldiers who continued to hunt the rugged terrain. Marcus had loved the legends. He'd once told her with a wink that the soldiers were his friends. In fact, he'd confided that Brigadier General Rufus Cunningham had been a big help when he decided to clean up, but he'd hoped his conversations with the long-dead man might cease once he was off the rum and heroin. She was down in the ravine with the dead man who'd been a mentor to her, and it was getting dark. This wasn't the time to mourn him. Only a few minutes had ticked by since she'd found him. There was no point in wishing him alive.
death was unmistakable. She dug into her pocket for her cell phone, praying it would work. Satellite communications here wasn't always the best. But she called Aaron and he answered on the second ring. She got the words out, hard as they were, and she told him she'd found Marcus, explaining that he'd appeared to have fallen.
CPR, do artificial respiration, Aaron said urgently.
Olivia looked at Marcus. She had truly loved the man. He was dead. He was cold. He was gone. There was no way she was attempting artificial respiration. He's dead, Aaron.
You can't be sure.
Aaron, I'm sure. I'm not trying artificial respiration. Get the officers to this location, please. She hung up and then she waited. Full darkness was coming, and coming soon. She felt that she had to keep her hand on Marcus's shoulder, that she had to be there with him. She hated that he'd been alone when he died. She hated that she was alone now, and that the last mauve of twilight was turning to gray and would soon become black. She always rode with a flashlight, but it was at the top of the ravine in the bag she'd attached to her saddle. She looked up as Sheila whinnied. The horse pranced nervously. Don't you leave me, boy, she called to him. It's all right. She broke off in mid-sentence. She hadn't actually grown up here. Not right here. About 20 miles west of Nashville, off I-40, but she'd grown up in the city. She'd often come out to her uncle's small ranch during her lifetime. She knew the legends of the area. Many times on foggy nights, she'd imagined that she'd seen them, and seen him, in the mist that covered the hills. She'd seen the rebel soldiers, cast from Nashville in 1862, trying to fight their way back, retreating in the darkness of the night. She'd imagined the blood-stained battlefields. She'd heard the cries of wounded and dying soldiers. She'd imagined seeing Brigadier General Rufus Cunningham, tall and straight and even sorrowful at the death toll of the war, as he watched his threadbare and beaten men ride by. But she'd never seen him so damn clearly. There, just above her, his white horse Loki stood feet from her own nervous Shiloh. The general stared down at her with sorrow and concern. He looked around as if he appointed himself her guardian. For a moment, she almost felt there was something malignant nearby, something evil that crept towards her in the night. Was that why the general was there? To protect her? Then she felt as if a cold wind settled near her. She felt something. Like a touch on her shoulder? She turned. There was Marcus Danby watching her. She blinked. She looked down. Marcus was dead on the ground before her. Ghosts. Her family was known for eccentricity, for seeing things, for knowing when it was going to rain, for a sense of foreboding when there was danger. Her family, not her. And she was looking up at a Civil War general and turning to see that the dead man before her was touching her shoulder from behind. She'd never thought of herself as a coward, but she was.
Live, Marcus said. Live. I'm dead. Help me. I didn't slide back into drugs. I didn't. And it wasn't an accident. I was killed, Liv. I was murdered. Help me.
A strangled sounding scream escaped her lips. She heard that much. Then she keeled over on top of Marcus Danby's body in a dead faint. Book 12. The Cursed. Prologue. Ghost Stories. The children screamed in the night as they felt the fire surround them, as they felt the ash, as they breathed in the smell like a bad fried chicken that drifted on the air, a smell that must have been the victim's burning flesh. As he emerged from the bathroom, Stuart Bell waved his arms over his head in a ridiculously, he hoped, spooky way. He was trying to be funny. Not that the event had been funny.
A dozen children and adults had once been killed in a fire here at the bed and breakfast, but that had been a long time ago. Still, he was apparently not funny at all. He could see that Shelley was genuinely scared. She had been since they'd embarked on the Key West ghost tour early that night. The friends who had taken the tour with them had all shaken off everything even remotely scary at their last stop, the haunted Hard Rock Cafe, when they imbued a few island specials and discussed some of the stories their guide had been telling them, despite having been told that a member of the Curry family had committed suicide in the ladies' room. Everyone was having a great time except for Shelley. Judy and Pete Atkinson, married grad students, were living it up away from the kids' school and responsibilities. Mark Rorden and Yarby Catalino had kept up, matching them drink for drink. Shelley, however, at one blue, flowery beverage all night, but left most of it behind. The others had talked about the past and even laughed at the spooky melodramas their guide had re-encountered. But Shelley took such stories to heart, she was still nervous. He and Shelley Nicholson had been a couple since their junior year at the University of Miami, and they both believed they would stay together once they graduated. She was even looking for a graphic art job in the same city, Plantation, where he already had something lined up. Stuart loved Shelley. He didn't like to see her genuinely frightened. She offered him a weak smile. She'd already changed into a pair of Disney pajamas. Pretty obvious he wasn't getting through those cute characters tonight. He didn't care. He just wanted her to feel better. "I know you're trying to help," she said. He caught her by the shoulders and urged her down on the luxurious bed.
"They're just stories," he told her. "Sad memory of someone else's past."
"Yes, but I can feel the stories. Does that make sense?" she asked.
"In a way, yes," he thought,
giving where they were staying. The owner of the Siren of the Sea bed and breakfast, Hannah O'Brien, believed in doing it upright. The house had been built in 1839, and the care it had received over the years was extraordinary. He had, he thought, done exceptionally well in choosing a place to stay for their trip down to southernmost city of the United States. But Shelley whispered, "If only we hadn't stayed here." Of course, the tour that night had started out from their bed and breakfast. Hannah herself, a lovely young woman not much older than they were, had been their tour guide, and she started with the tale of the B&B's own ghost. There were several, supposedly. The most often seen was Melody Chandler, who paced the widow's walk atop the roof, eternally waiting for her lover, Hagen Dundee, to return from the sea. He had died saving lives rather than cargo when his father's ship, Wind and Sea, had floundered just minutes after striking out from Key West, dashed to pieces on the reef by the sudden rise of a summer storm. There had been rumors of violent fighting with another salvager in the midst of the wicked storm. Rumors that suggested Dundee had actually been murdered. Melody had been convinced he wasn't dead, that she would have felt it if he had perished. 2 weeks later, in the midst of another storm, she saw lights on the water and believed her lover had somehow survived in the ocean and been helped by a passing boat that was returning him to the shore. She had raced down to what was now Smathers Beach, only to be swept away herself in the raging gale. Now, Melody was sometimes seen on the beach when the sun set and the night came on, while at other times she paced the roof of the Siren of the Sea. Occasionally, she was even observed in the backyard, where what had once been a pond was now a small swimming pool, surrounded by tiled paths, lush greenery, and beautiful flowers. And Hagen, well, Hagen had been seen opening the doors of the bed and breakfast, time and again, searching for Melody. "They're real," Shelley said. "I can feel them. I just can't go to sleep right now. I'm too wound up." Stuart felt himself perk up at those words, but the feeling was quickly dashed when she saw the hope in his eyes. "No, I do not want to fool around," she said. "Stuart, I'm sorry, but I just can't." He heard laughter from outside, soft and quiet. There were rules here at the Siren of the Sea. Hannah didn't close the pool at night.
she only asked her guests to be quiet and respectful of others.
Okay, Stuart said. That's okay. But if you can't sleep, why don't we join whoever is out at the pool? There's even a small hot tub. Maybe that will make you sleepy.
Shelley's nod of gratitude was worth a night of not fooling around. He felt like a hero just from the way she was looking at him. She rose, diving for her suitcase and bathing suit. He quickly grabbed his own trunks and tried not to watch her change. Even though she was scared, he couldn't help himself and was feeling pretty hot and bothered.
Not much to see, though. She changed quickly, then turned and gave him her beaming smile. I think there are some beers in the mini fridge, he said.
She shook her head. No more alcohol, please.
Soda?
Sure, thanks. That was another high point of the Siren of the Sea. Every one of the 6 large bedrooms contained a mini fridge and microwave. Stuart collected 2 plastic bottles of soda, grabbed a couple of towels, and smiled at Shelley, who smiled back, looking a little less frightened. They left the room quietly and headed down the stairs. Whoever had been there earlier was gone. He set the sodas and towels on the old Victorian lawn chairs by the pool and jumped in. It was a small pool, only 15 feet by 30, adjoined by a small circular hot tub. Shelley followed him in. For a few minutes, they swam silently. And then, in unspoken agreement, they slipped over the divider into the hot tub. They sat together for a while, still without talking. The night was beautiful. A full moon rode high in the sky, and nearby hibiscus bushes and tree limbs thick with green leaves moved gently in the breeze.
Are you okay?
He asked Shelley finally. She nodded. This was good, thank you, she smiled. I love you. Let's dry off. I think I can sleep now. They hopped out and went to get their towels. Stuart loved the period lawn chairs. They made him think of giant mansions and croquet fields, with men in knickers and women in white gowns wearing big white hats to shade their faces from the sun. Wanna lie here and dry off for a few minutes? Shelley asked him.
Sure, great.
They stretched out their towels and lay in the moonlight, hands entwined as they looked up at the stars. Hannah kept subtly arranging the lights burning in the garden and then gently illuminating the lawn with their soft glow. The spring day had been warm and the night was kissed by a pleasantly balmy breeze. Stuart closed his eyes.
It's beautiful here, he murmured. Too bad that massive ad agency that wants to hire me, the almost big bucks, isn't down here, because I could live here.
Easily, she whispered. Peace and serenity surrounded him. He really did love the Keys. There was something magical that happened once you left the mainland behind. The air was so soft and nice. The lounge was comfortable that he began to drift off. Then Shelley screamed. It was a scream of pure and absolute terror. His eyes flew open as he bolted up and saw a strange man standing over Shelley. The stranger was gripping his throat with his right hand and making croaking noises. Stuart was too startled, too terrified to be sure, but it looked as though something was oozing through the man's fingers.
Blood?
In his left hand, the stranger held a knife, a huge Bowie knife. He heard another scream and realized that, just like Shelley, he too was screaming in pure, gut-wrenching, primal terror. He thought he saw the knife move, glittering silver and red in the moonlight as the stranger raised it and then sent it slashing down towards Shelley. Stay tuned for the next 2 books from the Crew of Hunter series.
Thank you for spending time with me today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Feel free to leave a review and subscribe to my show. Thank you again, and remember, dream big and keep reading.